Now, Christian theology has a very long history. The greatest question at first was the nature of Christ. Did he have one nature, which was divine, or two natures, divine and human, or just what was the relation between his divine nature and his human nature? And they finally agreed at the Council of Chalcedon that Jesus was fully man and fully God. And if that was a paradox, difficult to understand, well, that would be the fault of your poor, weak human understanding. Paradoxes are all right in the divine world, which is beyond human understanding. Anyhow, that's the orthodox conclusion, fully man and fully God. But it took them about 400 years of wrangling and actual bloody fighting to arrive at that conclusion. At the first council, the whole argument, Council of Nicaea, 325, the whole argument was Christ of the same substance, or was he of like substance with God? Homoousion or homoousion? It was a dispute about a single letter in one word. And it was a terrific dispute, and they got to fighting over it. In fact, there were wars about it. And the Nestorians and Arians and Athanasians and others all were either one nature or two nature persons. Finally, they decided that Jesus was of the same substance and not of like substance. Well, questions like that seem very foreign to us today, and so they should be. At the time of the rise of the Society of Friends, there was a very sharp theological difference between the Quakers and their Puritan opponents. And when I say opponents, I really mean that, because the Puritans were very, very strong in their opposition to Quakerism. They thought the Quakerism was pure anarchy and would undermine all the established institutions if it was allowed to grow. And so they did everything they could to suppress it by putting as many Quakers as they could in prison and depriving them often of all their property. But they disagreed on several fundamental points, such as the Quakers believed that the inner light was in every human being, whether he was a Chinaman or a African or a Hindu or whatever it might be, whereas the Puritans believed that only the elect, only those who were chosen by God, had any notion of the divine spirit. And the Quakers believed in free will, and the Puritans believed in predestination, that God had determined from all eternity who should be damned and who should be saved. The Quakers believed that you were saved by following the inner light and becoming identified with it. The Puritans believed that you were saved by the blood of Christ shed on the cross. He was a sacrifice to appease the anger of God. God was angry at man because of his sin. He demanded a penalty, and his son came forward and offered himself as the lamb who was generally sacrificed to appease an angry God in Hebrew law. He offered himself as a sacrifice to save not all human beings, but only the elect. And there were a number of other differences. But let's skip down to almost present time. I'll speak about several controversies that existed in my own memory, which goes far enough back to include quite a few changes. As I remember the theological situation about the beginning of the 20th century, along about 1900, it was very largely a debate between the fundamentalists and the modernists. The fundamentalists believed that the Bible was absolutely true from cover to cover. There were no mistakes in it, and it must be accepted as absolutely historical. Fact is that they did not accept, although they professed to accept all of the Bible, they did not actually do so. For instance, Jesus said, "Swear not at all." And they didn't hesitate to swear, and so on. I could give a good many cases of where the fundamentalists, in spite of their absolute assertion that the Bible was completely true down to the... And here they were thinking of the King James Version. They didn't even know there was a Greek version first. they couldn't even stand the change of a comma. The liberals, on the other hand, the modernists, wanted to treat the Bible like an ordinary book, find out who wrote it, when it was written, under what circumstances, what was myth and what was history. Obviously, a great deal of it was myth, and some of it was history, but it was hard to tell which was myth and which was history sometimes, and that could only be done by very careful analysis. But they would treat the Bible as you would treat any other book that you were investigating. And in the case of Christ himself, obviously a good many myths had grown up about Christ before the four Gospels were written. The Gospels were not written before about 70 A.D., and during those years there was time for a good many stories to grow up in the Christian church which were accepted as fact, stories like the virgin birth and so on. The modernists did not accept that what they thought were myths, legends, either in the Old Testament, which had many legends in it, like Adam and Eve and so on, and the New Testament also was partly historical and obviously partly legendary. But mostly the legends stood for something. They weren't pure inventions. One of the most influential modern books on theology was written by a man called Bultmann, a German, and called Demythologizing the Bible. How can you demythologize it? How can you take the myth out of it? And when you take the myth out of it, what do you have left? It wasn't a case of debunking the Bible. It was just the opposite. He was trying to make it more important, to show what these myths might have signified in the minds of those who first thought of them, what they were trying to designate. Religion always speaks in terms of symbols. Symbols are the language of religion, and every religion has developed myths in order to explain certain spiritual facts which might not be explained in any other way. When I was speaking about Jung, I didn't mention his book on symbols, which is one of his most interesting books. He distinguishes between a symbol and a sign, and he investigates the symbols of nearly all religions in the attempt to show just what they might indicate. A sign is something you can understand rationally. A symbol is partly conscious and partly subconscious. Now, you take the cross, the most important Christian symbol. If you say the cross indicates that Jesus set us a good example by dying for our sakes or by suffering in our behalf, that would be a rationalization. That would be a sign. You try to explain the cross or the sacrifice on the cross in a rational way. Jesus showed that martyrdom is the natural consequence of holding fast to your own religious ideas. But I think most people go a good deal further than that. The cross means something more than you can explain by your reason. It's partly subconscious. It's a sense that there is at the heart of existence suffering, and that God suffers for us. And the cross signifies in some mysterious way that we can't quite explain, don't have to explain, the idea that God is suffering for us, and that suffering is a necessary part of the world which God has created. It's not an evil part, because suffering can be an atonement. It can be a way of overcoming something. Josiah Royce, my professor at Harvard, used to lecture on Christianity. And his lectures on Christianity were always crowded, although the room was a huge one. There were people standing in the aisles wanting to hear what Royce had to say about Christianity. Well, one of his lectures was on atonement. And he tried to show how, in any human society, a sacrificial death might atone for some evil in that society. It wouldn't cancel the evil, but it would overcome it. It would replace it with something better, so that the evil, instead of being evil anymore, would become a good, because that death had atoned or created a situation in which the evil had been overcome by goodness. And Royce believed that every evil in the world is eventually overcome by goodness. So evil is a temporary thing, whereas goodness is eternal in his philosophy. And Royce's philosophy was, in general, the philosophy of the liberals, like Rufus Jones, Harry Emerson Fosdick, and many other liberal writers who followed Royce's idealism. And these liberals felt that evil was somewhat less real than good. The good would always prevail in the end just because it was good. There's something enduring about good. But the evil man not only destroys himself, he destroys his environment. And by destroying his environment, he destroys himself. So evil is self-destructive, and it is therefore temporary, and eventually it will be overcome. So in the final end, in the absolute world, the world of absolute being, there is eternal goodness. And God is eternal goodness, eternal love, which overcomes every evil that exists in the end. Not right away, but in the long run, evil is overcome by goodness. And that was the general feeling we all had at that time. Everybody believed in the idea of progress. We were obviously becoming wiser and wiser all the time. Science was adding to our knowledge very fast, making new discoveries all the time. And since we were knowing more, it must necessarily follow that we're getting better. We didn't realize at that time that knowing more and getting better were not at all the same thing, as we've since discovered. But during those rosy days, when we thought that war had been forever abolished, like dualism, it was a thing of the past, we all thought that there would be no more wars. And then there came the Great World War, First World War, and then the Second World War, and the liberals kind of faded out. These liberal optimists gave way to the more pessimistic theology of Karl Barth and Emil Brunner and others, who were called neo-Orthodox or neo-Calvinist. They had the same ideas as Calvin had, except they accepted the biblical criticism. They accepted the idea that we do not know very much about the historic Christ, but we do know a great deal about the Christ of faith. And what they talked about was the Christ of faith and not the Christ of history, because the high Christ of history is hidden behind the legends which have grown up about him. But the Christ of faith, that is something about which we can talk, and that is the Christ that is revealed in the New Testament. And Karl Barth believed that in predestination, that God had predetermined everything in advance, and the kingdom of heaven would come when God chose to let it come. Nothing that we could do could make it come any sooner. I heard him tell that at Amsterdam in 1948, and he said, "There is no Marshall Plan for the kingdom of heaven." That is, there's no kind of a human scheme which can bring it about. It's purely within the choice of God, and all your righteousness, what the Puritans used to talk about, the filthy rags of righteousness. The Puritans didn't believe that your righteousness did you any good at all. The only thing that got you to heaven was the election of God, not your righteousness. And Karl Barth believed the same thing. I remember Queen Juliana, who had just become queen a few days before, with great celebrations, which we all enjoyed. She was on the platform with Karl Barth, and she disagreed with him. She felt that why did God require us to be righteous, or ask us to be righteous, or to do righteous things, if our righteousness didn't do any good, if it didn't help bring about the kingdom of heaven? Well, Karl Barth, of course, stuck to his ideas, and the Barthian movement became a very powerful movement, so that in every Christian theological seminary, the Barthians were in a majority, just as the liberals had been in a majority a few years before.